This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the January 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Outsider by Robert J. Tilley. At first sighting, Marcus estimated that the pub was about 3/4 of a mile away, roughly equidistant from the hills that formed the flanks of the small valley in which it sat in shadowed isolation. He spotted it as they crested the southern range, a fairly substantial building, its details rapidly becoming obscured by the gathering dusk. There was still sufficient daylight, though, to permit identification. The parking lot beside it, fronted by its supplementary sign, the garden and white tables at its rear. Good timing, he thought, relieved. There was a chill in the air, and clouds were beginning to thicken darkly above the eastern horizon. Despite its bleakly inevitable lack of welcoming occupants, the pub still generated associations of warmth and relaxed conviviality, a friendly refuge. Some of its contents would probably prove to be distasteful, of course. They could be removed and evidence of their presence at least partially disguised. The smell of disinfectant was something that he accepted as an essential part of their world now. They were roughly a third of the way down the gently coiling road when the light appeared, a small patch of brightness that winked into sudden existence at the side of the building facing their line of approach. Marcus's first thought was that it was simply an open window catching the last rays of the almost vanished sun, a final trace of the dying day briefly captured by the angle of the glass. But as remnants of daylight continued to fade and the sun finally slid below the curving line of the hills, the light grew brighter, a small, enigmatic, rectangular beacon that gradually caused him to drift to a halt at the edge of the road. The building was barely visible now, blurred to a misshapen shadow in the gloom, the light the only certain evidence of its location. He said, frowning, "There's someone down there. There's no other explanation." He bit his lip. "Is there?" Paul said, "No. There's been no power of any kind for more than 2 months now. It's most probably an oil lamp. Whatever it is, somebody had to light it." "What about an auxiliary generator?" Paul shrugged. "Same thing. It would still need someone to operate it. And the light came on only a couple of minutes ago." Marcus nodded, his initial sense of shock already subsiding. He knew that he could always rely on Paul to rationalize things, stay cool and unflurried in the face of the unanticipated. Although he vaguely tended to think of himself as the leader of the trio, he relied on the strengths of the others to bolster his own impetuosity and fits of depression. He'd often reflected that without them, he very probably wouldn't have survived as long as he had. But Paul's steadiness and common sense and Alan's ability to detect the bizarre humor of their situation continued to hold at bay the despair that ceaselessly prowled around the perimeter of his consciousness. "Female?" Alan speculated. "Tallish, but not exactly Amazonian. Preferably blonde, in her late 20s. Attractive, of course, and an enterprising cook." Marcus smiled. "And with the right sense of humor, of course." "You mean she'd have to laugh at your jokes? Oh, essential." Marcus continued to smile wryly. The chances of their meeting such an idealized companion were woefully improbable, of course. There had been women among the handful of survivors that they'd encountered since beginning the trek north, but none of them had remotely resembled Alan's flippantly sardonic specification. A capacity for survival was all that mattered now. The ability to adapt, to manufacture and preserve some kind of tolerable existence in the aftermath of disaster. He flexed his shoulders, easing the pressure of the pack and bedroll where they lay heavily across his back. Whoever it is, they have to be immune, I suppose. I wonder if there's more than one. Paul said, there might be. There's no guarantee that they'll welcome strangers either. Remember what's happened before? They might think that we're carriers. Better keep the gun handy. Marcus nodded again, wriggled free of the pack and took the gun from it. The muddle felt hard and dependable against his hand. He unzipped his jacket and wedged the gun behind his belt at his left side, its butt facing forward. He zippered his jacket again, then eased the pack back on. It was almost dark now, a moonless, cold evening with a touch of rawness in the air. Right then, let's see what we've got here. An erratic breeze was funneling through the valley as they reached level ground. The stench of manure could still be detected there, to some extent masking the other smells brought to them on the gusting wind. At least the darkness hid the source, Marcus thought. He'd learned to detect the subtle differences by now, the somehow coarser pungency of animal decomposition as compared with its human counterpart. In his mind's eye, he visualized the occupants of the surrounding fields, most of them, perhaps all, reduced to scattered mounds of putrefaction, their slow disintegration unaided by the traditional visitations of scavengers whose own ranks had been brutally decimated to a handful of cautiously selective survivors, instinctively mistrustful of infected flesh. Animal and bird still bred, but it would be a long time before some semblance of normality returned to field and woodland and sky. Cities and towns, too, he supposed, although they didn't really matter anymore. Perhaps it will be their world now, he thought. Perhaps humankind will simply fade away, increasingly insulated from the possibility of continuity by its terror of contagion, ironically doomed to extinction by its capacity for reasoned fear. There was some kind of vehicle parked in the shadows beside the pub. He thought its dully metal glint as they passed the parking lot and approached the building, their footsteps muffled by the grass fringe beside the road. The curve of the road had taken them some way to its right. From this adjusted angle of approach, Marcus saw that, in fact, three windows were illuminated. The one that they had first seen, located in the side of the building, and two others at its left front center, previously hidden. He could see the lighted room now, bathed in the whitish glow of the lamp that sat on a table directly adjacent to the front corner window. At first, no one was visible. Then, a shadow drifted across the far side of the room, and a figure moved briefly into view, before vanishing again, concealed by the corner wall. A woman? The sighting had lasted no more than a second, but he'd caught a glimpse of what could have been long, dark hair. Meaningless, he told himself. His own hair was almost shoulder length by now. The others maintained the same relatively neat styles that they'd affected throughout their acquaintance, a consistency of image that he found reassuring in a way, but simultaneously interpreted as a silent reproof aimed at his own more casual attitude toward such things. He frequently told himself that he ought to copy their example, despite there being little real point in such adherence to the old normality. But that wasn't important just now. He hesitated, uncertain of their next move. Paul whispered, "Better get a closer look. We can't really see enough from here." They moved sideways, avoiding the pool of light, towards the corner of the building. Marcus leaned against the wall, peering cautiously through the front corner window. He was looking into what was plainly the bar room. The woman was seated on a bar stool. her back towards them. She was fairly slim, the belted coat she was wearing shaped to contours, confirming her gender. Black, slightly wavy hair hung loosely down her back and across her shoulders. Her elbows were on the bar top, her hands hidden in front of her. Without being able to see them, Marcus guessed that she was holding a glass. As far as he could detect, there was no one else in the room. He felt a tremor of unease. The tableau beyond the window had a bizarre, almost waxworks quality about it, he thought. It was like an almost too precise scene of another kind of reality that lived only in the memory, the clean, orderly setting, warmed by the light of the lamp, the woman at the bar, the pose that she must have adopted at the moment of their arrival. Perhaps she wasn't the one that he'd seen. There could be other people in there, undetectable from where he stood. He ducked down and moved along the wall to the farther window, but even this extension of his viewpoint failed to reveal anyone else in the room. It was as though she was waiting for someone, he thought. He glanced uncertainly behind him, squinting into the surrounding gloom. Apart from the lighted windows, the darkness was almost total now. The only sound, the occasional sigh of the wind as it brushed past the walls of the building. Paul whispered, "Check around the side. We'll get a better view there." They moved quietly around the corner, simultaneously stepping back several yards into the shadow beyond the throw of light. Marcus stared through the side window, seeing the woman in profile now. This adjusted view appeared to confirm her solitude, but her face was indistinct, shadowed by the lamp behind her and partially masked by the curtain of hair. He could see the glass now, clasped between her hands where they rested on the bar, a tumbler, its dully amber contents almost reaching the brim. They moved away from the window again, carefully circumnavigated the building, then returned to their starting point and conferred. Despite the element of unreality, it was cautiously accepted that there was no logical reason for supposing that the situation contained any kind of genuine risk. Their inspection of the rear and farther side of the premises had failed to find any other lighted windows or additional evidence of occupancy, so it seemed reasonable to assume that the woman was alone, as she appeared to be. And in the by now improbable event that she was a carrier, Paul pointed out, their own immunity had long proved itself to be an established fact. But prudence would still be advisable. Marcus should go in alone, while he and Alan remained hidden until the position became clear. The woman's response to any new presence could range from terror to abject relief, and the arrival of an individual ostensibly posed less of a threat than that of a group. Marcus allowed his initial reluctance to be overcome by this reasoned argument. Too, the wind had risen and was already cutting searchingly through his clothing. It would be a relief to be indoors, sheltered by the thick stone walls. He took a deep breath and walked around the corner to the front of the building while the others melted into darkness. The door creaked as he opened it, and the lamp flickered, its flames stirred by the inrush of air. The woman swung around, her face drawn and startled. Marcus was disappointed to see that she was older than her rear view had led him to believe, certainly well past 40. It was a sallow, pouchy face, patterned with fretful lines. She wore lipstick, dark against the pale skin. They stared at one another for several seconds, Marcus politely guarded, the woman poised and wide-eyed. The glass in her hand slopped some of its contents onto the top of the bar, creating a slowly spreading pool. "Don't be alarmed," Marcus said. He placatingly lifted a hand, pushing the door closed behind him. "There's nothing to be frightened of. I wasn't expecting to find anyone around here." His voice sounded all right, he decided, calm and reassuring. He carefully shrugged out of his backpack and placed it on a bench beside him, conscious of the gun against his side. He and the woman were the only people in the room, but a door beyond the end of the bar counter was open, leading into an unlit corridor. He stayed where he was, lifting both hands now. "There's nothing to worry about, really." The woman said, "Who are you?" Some of the shock was leaving her face, but her voice was thick with barely disguised tension. It was a North Country voice, heavily accented. Her back view really had been misleading, Marcus thought. As well as being older than he'd anticipated, he'd somehow pictured someone less corpse-featured. She didn't look particularly intelligent, he decided. She could be a little drunk, too. He kept his hands open and raised carefully, manufacturing a smile. "My name's Aitken, Marcus Aitken. I'm on my way up to Edinburgh. I have," he corrected himself, "I had relatives there. I want to find out if any of them are still alive." The woman said after a pause, "I didn't hear any car." Hadn't she made any kind of logical deduction regarding his backpack? Obviously not. Well, it confirmed his estimate of how bright she was. He continued to smile. "I'm walking. I never learned to drive." "Are you on your own?" He hesitated only fractionally before replying. Better not bring the others in just yet, he thought. She might accept their presence, even be relieved by the time-honored concept of safety in numbers, but he couldn't be sure. She could react with alarm, feel more threatened, and like some of the others that they'd met, be panicked into doing something foolish or dangerous. He had no way of knowing whether or not she carried any kind of weapon. "Yes, there aren't many people left anywhere now. The ones I've met just seem to want to stay where they are." Careful, he thought. That could be interpreted as a kind of criticism, potentially dangerous ground. It's understandable, of course. They're used to being certain places, that kind of thing. He shrugged slowly, brought his hands down. "Look, there's no need to be frightened of me. All I want is sleep here tonight. Would you mind if I do that?" She continued to stare at him fixedly. Her eyes were no longer startled, but something else was growing there, a kind of hungry speculation. She ignored his question. "I can drive. I've got a car outside. I could take you to Edinburgh." This abrupt acceptance and invitation jarred him badly. Damn, he thought, dismayed. Perhaps he should have told her about the others straight away, after all. But it was always difficult to know what was best in such a situation. Each stranger was an unknown quantity, an unpredictable and potentially risky intrusion into their world, and previous encounters had sometimes gone badly when their group presence had been realized. "I'd better not tell her just yet," he thought. Such an abrupt reversal of his claim to solitariness would be bound to invoke instant mistrust. He'd better establish some kind of relationship first, attempt to manufacture an area of common ground before tactfully revealing their presence. But there was no question of her joining them, he thought. Apart from her age and appearance, he could sense the total absence of rapport between them. He'd learned to detect such things long ago, as far back as his early childhood, and his ensuing limited relationships had always been dictated by his instinct in such things. Their meeting could have spanned only a minute or two so far, but already he knew that she was a creature responsive to a different code of signals, the possessor of criteria alien to that of himself and the others. He smiled again. "That's very kind of you." He looked around the bar. "Is this where you were living when it happened?" She slowly shook her head. "I'm from Bolton. Did you know anybody here?" She shook her head again. There was a shadow of color in her face now. "No, I was just driving. I got here 2 days ago." "Were there many survivors in Bolton?" The color went again, abruptly. Her face trembled, suddenly slack and lost. She began to cry. He stayed where he was, further dismayed. He'd never been able to cope with tears and the appalling loss of control prompted by their activation. He thought briefly about his wife and their eventually disastrous relationship, the mutual death of understanding, punctuated by complaints and recriminations, and always tears. "It's a weapon, really," he thought. "They know we can't handle it when they cry." He remained tactfully still and silent as the woman began to talk, her voice thick and halting at first, but gradually resolving into a dull, hurting whine. He listened to her catalog of personal disaster with part of his mind, but principally was reflecting with relief on his own circumstances. It was hard to see any really acceptable future, but compared with most of the people that he'd encountered since it had all happened, his luck had been incredible. Despite their tentative deductions, he still didn't know for sure why he and Paul and Alan should have remained immune, but the passage of time had established it as a fact, now proven beyond all doubt. All around him, people had died, slow, suffering ends, most of them, as the virus permeated their systems, first inducing fever, then dehydration and eventual death. His wife had been an early victim, a shock that had been smothered by the magnitude of what was happening everywhere. For days, he'd wandered the northern suburbs of London, desperately seeking familiar faces among the steadily dwindling handful of survivors that he found, some of them, like him, searching for family or friends or acquaintances, the majority locked away in what had become private fortresses against the unbelievable horror of it all, their presences betrayed only by a half-seen face at a window, an occasional moving curtain. He'd been near total despair when Paul and Alan appeared. They'd arrived one evening after he'd returned to the flat at the end of another fruitless day, an instinctive homing ritual meaningless in itself, but one that could have meant their never locating each other if he had lapsed into the kind of rootless wandering practiced by some. Their presence was like a sudden shaft of daylight entering his dark existence. Both unmarried, Paul and Alan had been on a walking tour of Wales when the virus swept like an unseen shadow across the country and the world. The holiday had been an annual get-together in which he normally joined, but pressure of work had made it impossible on that last occasion. They'd spent a week, they told him, doing what they could for local victims before the scale of hopelessness of the task became evident. Then they had split up and gone to their parents' homes, but rejoined forces shortly afterwards when the pointlessness of this filial loyalty had been proved. It was then that they decided to look for him, in the all too probably vain hope that he too had somehow survived. They'd laughed and talked, his own laughter near hysteria initially, but gradually subsiding to normality As he grew to accept the blessed fact of their reunion, they were both plainly shaken by their experience, but neither had really changed. Paul, fundamentally serious, but with a dry, precisely worded sense of humor. Alan, the extrovert, the compulsive conversationalist, the more overtly comic. They'd gravitated towards each other during their college days, an unlikely alliance in some respects, but one that they collectively found pleasurable. And after graduating, they'd made it a point to stay in touch over the intervening years. Their survival, like his, remained unexplained, but a solitary clue had existed from the start. Both he and Paul had AB positive blood, an oddity that they'd learned during their last year in college after deciding that actual donation was the only way to overcome their mutual aversion to a form of public service that they found commendable. It had become something of a running joke that they periodically teased one another with. Blood brothers, they'd called themselves. At the time, Alan had been unable to overcome his own squeamishness, and his blood category remained unknown. Could he, too, belong to the same relatively rare group? They'd speculated endlessly on the freakishness of such a coincidence, the only straw of possibility that offered itself, while simultaneously accepting that explanations were of no real importance. All that did matter, they'd agreed, was that they were together, sustaining each other through the nightmare, repelling it with their companionship and unwavering compatibility. The woman's voice had leveled to a monotone now, heavy with exhaustion that was largely emotional. Eventually, she stopped talking, the sound petering to silence. She stared past him, her face streaked and her eyes dull and blind. She's talked herself out, he thought. Now would be the best time to tell her. He said gently, "It's a terrible thing, being alone, I know." He looked around the bar. "This is a nice place. I can see why you decided to stay here for a while." He walked a little ways from her, unzipping his coat and glancing at the empty table and seats. He turned, spreading his hands. "Look, I must tell you, I didn't tell you before because I thought you'd be more scared. I have two friends with me. We decided it would be best if they waited outside until I'd talked to you and made you realize that there wasn't anything to be frightened of. You aren't frightened anymore, are you?" She didn't reply, simply stared blankly at him. Did she understand what he was saying, he wondered. "I'll fetch them. It's getting pretty cold outside. They'll be glad to get indoors." He went to the door, conscious of her eyes following, his carefully unhurried movements. He opened it and looked out into the darkness. "It's all right. You can come in now." They emerged out of the gloom and went past him into the bar. He shut the door and turned, gesturing introductions. "This is Paul, and this is Alan. We were friends at college. We still don't know why we all..." He stopped. The woman left her stool and was stepping sideways through the open counter flap, her head turned in their direction, her eyes flickering restlessly. She reached below the counter, and the twin barrels of a shotgun appeared above its far edge. He fumbled the gun from his belt and fired, crouching. His first shot missed, but the explosion and the shattering glass behind her panicked the woman into half turning away, her eyes squeezed closed. His second shot threw her against the rear wall, dislodging more bottles. She fell, disappearing beneath the counter. A brief silence was broken, and another bottle slid free of its holder and dropped, making a soft, muffled sound on landing. It must have fallen on her, he thought. He remained crouching, the grun stretched out in front of him, listening for any further sign of movement. There was no sound of any kind. Still, pointing the gun, he went behind the counter. The woman lay on her stomach, her head twisted sideways in a reeking pool of spirits, the barrels of the shotgun projecting from beneath her body. He could see the bullet hole, a dark opening in the side of her head, partially concealed by strands of her hair. He swallowed his revulsion and disappointment. He hadn't wanted anything like this to happen, but already he was used to it in a way. People's responses had become increasingly irrational since the disaster. It could be just normal fear, he supposed, but alternatively, it could mean that they hadn't fully escaped the effects of the virus after all. Perhaps some individuals had avoided death only to have their minds harmed in some way, a kind of insanity that was the price to be paid for staying alive. Paul and Alan came out from where they'd taken shelter and consoled him, pointing out that he'd had no choice. In fact, the shotgun, on inspection, turned out to be empty, but he'd had no way of knowing that. They left the bar and went upstairs, relieved to find no other bodies and no lingering odor of decomposition. The beds were neatly made and rooms clean, evidence of some final gesture of refusal to except the inevitability of a disordered end. He wondered where the people were who'd run the place, where exactly it was that they died. Not that it mattered, of course. Location was one of the least important aspects of death. He slumped tiredly onto one of the beds, thinking about the woman. For a brief moment, just prior to their actual meeting, the possibility had existed that he and the others had found a companion to share the curtailments of their existence, to round out the question of human needs. But she hadn't been right, he knew. Instinct had told him of the absence of compatibility, that the kind of empathetic relationship that they'd sought had once again been no more than a dream. He pulled the covers over him and drifted into sleep, lulled by the gusting wind outside the bedroom. On the following morning, they breakfasted in the kitchen, augmenting their own supplies with the few edible items that they found. They briefly discussed the events of the evening, but it was generally agreed that there would be no point in burying the body. After all, she was simply one of countless millions, and what had happened had been unavoidable. They left by the rear entrance and walked away from the building, heading towards the low range of hills on the far side of the valley. It was a bright, clear day, with a faint breeze, the only reminder of the previous evening's sharp-edged wind. It was a relief to be leaving there, Marcus thought. What had happened had been unfortunate, but in a way, it had been for the best. The woman's frightening readiness to batten on to him, followed by her pathetic monologue and then the abrupt reversion to dangerous antagonism when the presence of the others had been made known, had demonstrated her instability. Really, she was better off now, free of the ghosts that she endlessly mourned and no longer a threat to those like himself, who had mercifully remained untouched by this appalling alternative to death. And the truth, of course, was that she would never have fitted in, would always have been an unwanted intruder, a potentially destructive element that might ultimately have endangered the homogeneous balance of the group and the tolerable existence that they had created to insulate them from the ever-present nightmare. He talked to Paul and Alan as he walked, a lone, chattering figure, his solitary figure darkening beside him. And he began the climb that led out of the valley and towards the beckoning north. We continue with a story from the December 1985 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is A Matter of No Great Significance, where the atmosphere merged with the mesosphere and the earthward plunging particles flickered like brilliant fireflies and went out. An enormous vessel turned in slow splendor above the turning world below. Part artifact, part organism, if it resembled anything known to man, it might perhaps have been a fragile, long-limbed bristle star, but one conjured out of blown glass and gold and silver filigree, then set to swim the unthinkably cold tides of starlight among the eternal silences of deepest space. The vessel had a name, though it was not strictly translatable in human terms, being a concept compounded from the notions of search and pursuit and quest. The nearest human equivalent would probably be God Seeker. It also had a number, 2723. Its point of origin was the planetary system of a faint star that lay in a distant limb of our galaxy, far, far too remote to be detected by the naked eye of even the most gifted Babylonian astronomer. And the optical telescope still awaited invention years and years ahead in the undreamed of future of humanity. The mysterious visitor was about to depart from the solar system, freighted with treasure gleaned from the shadowy continents and the dark ocean depths. The little fairy capsules rose like silver bubbles through the Earth's atmosphere to be reunited with their host. By the time the parent ship had completed its penultimate global circuit, of the 30 little craft it had dispatched to our planet's surface, 29 had homed in successfully and were now ranged along its feathery limbs like glittering dewdrops on a cobweb. The crews of the capsules assembled in the great hall and exchanged greetings. To a human eye, unable to perceive their double hearts and their four vocal cords, the creatures who made up the gathering would have appeared to be both human and identical. To themselves and to eyes that were sensitive to a range of electromagnetic radiation far wider than that to which the human retina is sensitive, they were all distinct one from another, as any equivalent gathering of 87 human beings would have been, with one proviso: not one of them possessed a single visible physical characteristic that would have allowed them to be classed as either male or female. When the 29th crew had checked in, the holographic image of a mission controller was projected upon a balcony above. Two thin golden bands encircled his left forearm. He held up his right hand, and the murmuring died into silence. "You have done well and have earned your rest," he informed his audience in a tongue that to a human ear would have sounded closer to music than to speech. The primary collocation is extremely promising. Mentor Michalis wishes me to convey to all of you his gratitude and his profound satisfaction. He paused and then continued in a slightly different tone. "As you are all aware, our aim is to proceed directly home via the prevalent spatial interstices, whose disposition will remain favorable to us for the duration of precisely two further planetary rotations. It was our intention to transfer to our departure mode as soon as you were all safely aboard. Unfortunately, during the course of the 23rd rotation, we lost contact with Melchior's vessel. Since then, We have ascertained that Melchior and his companions are safe and are now making their way to their prearranged emergency recovery point. On our next circuit, Iphis Bractor will descend under cover of darkness and retrieve them. If, for whatever reason, they fail to make the rendezvous, he must perforce return without them, for we dare not run the risk of any further delay. However, we do not anticipate that this will be necessary. We will keep you informed of what transpires. Once more, I thank you for what I am convinced will prove to have been a highly successful mission. May you rest well. He raised his hand once more in salute, turned, and was gone. Towards evening, on the second day of their journey, the wind shifted round to the northeast, blowing down the rocky valley from the snow-fingered mountain pinks that lay between the three travelers and the distant sea. Within an hour, it had rolled the clouds away inland. Long, slender shafts of rose-pink light came lancing down across the southern hills, softening their harsh outlines with smudges of delicate purple shadow. A wavering skein of wild geese flew honking high overhead, seeking the salt marshes far to the south. The strangers rode in single file, following the narrow track that wound beside the chattering stream. By now, they had grown accustomed to the awkward, lurching gait of their steeds and had learned to trust them to pick their own sure-footed way along the stony paths. By and by, they came to a place where the water tumbled over a shelf of rock into a shallow pool, and a thick cluster of thorny bushes afforded some shelter from the sharp teeth of the wind. The leader reined up his mount, then leaned forward, struck it lightly on the side of its long, arching neck, and spoke a word of command. Obediently, it shuffled forward, sank down onto its broad, knobby knees, and allowed him to step off. The other two men followed suit. Freed of their burdens, the animals lurched to their feet, then lolloped forward into the water, where they lowered their heads and began drinking noisily. The western sky darkened precipitately to a deep magenta and became latticed with bars of gold. These faded even as they watched them, first to bright bronze and then to a smoldering coppery red. One of the men unfastened the thong of a tooled leather satchel and took out a fistful of dried figs, which he offered to his companions. They stood side by side, contemplating the sunset and munching at the sweet, gritty fruit. The man with the satchel, whose name was Caspar, spoke for the first time in many hours. "How much farther is it, Mel?" The leader glanced back at the mountains they had left. Then he pushed back the loose sleeve of his thick woolen robe and consulted an instrument that was strapped to the inside of his wrist. "From here, it cannot be more than 4 sterces," he said. "More likely, 3.5. And whom are they sending for us, did they say?" "Iphis Bractor. He too speaks the tongue." Caspar sucked the stickiness from his fingertips. "Iphis, huh? Well, I don't mind telling you, I'll never have been gladder to see anyone." "Me too," said Balthazar. "Imagine spending the rest of your days down here." "Remembering some of the places we've been, we could have faced a great deal worse," said Melchior mildly. "This world has much to offer. It has great beauty. I feel Zervan's presence here." His companions eyed him with a mixture of respect, affection, and wry amusement. The one named Balthazar said, "And just when have you not felt Zervan's presence, Mel?" Melchior smiled. "It is true, nonetheless. To deny it would be to deny Zervan himself. I sense a profound stillness here, like that which lies at the center of a Niphean vortex before the flow reverses. Mentor Mikalos must have felt it too." No doubt it was that which caused the earth to open and swallow up our capsule, suggested Caspar, and he helped himself to another fig. Along the eastern horizon, the mountains withdrew themselves into the violet shadows. Above them, a solitary star emerged, swimming imperceptibly up towards the zenith. With one accord, the men turned and watched it in silence, until finally Melchior said, 4 starsies yet. Come, we must be on our way. A full moon arose as they approached the valley's end. Its pale light silvered the dark spears of the wind-tossed cypresses and scribbled faint shadows across the ragged tufts of wayside grass. Somewhere among the hills to the south, a wild dog began to howl, and then another answered it. The melancholy lament rose and fell upon the back of the gusting breeze. Caspar shivered, drew the hood of his cloak down around his ears, and urged his animal up alongside Melchior's. Which way now? Melchior pointed to the northwest and drove his mount forward up to the slope of the low hill. On the summit, Melchior once more consulted the instrument on his wrist. That's it over there, he said. The hill on the other side of the village. We still have ample time. The camels picked their way down the slope to the dusty white ribbon of the road and began plodding sedately towards the cluster of lime-washed houses. The harness jingled faint and musical in the frosty air. The breeze blowing upon their backs carried their scent before them. A dog caught it and began to bark. The houses were all settled down for the night, their wooden shutters closed fast against the prying wind. Here and there, a fugitive streak of yellow lamplight gleamed through a chink. From one building, the last one of all, came the sound of voices raised in drunken song. As they rode past, a man emerged from the shadows of the backyard and stepped out into the street. He peered up at Melchior, then ran forward, reached up, and caught hold of the hem of his woolen cloak. Melchior reined up his camel and gazed down at him in mild astonishment. Are you not the doctor? I sent for a doctor 3 hours ago. What is it? Demanded Caspior. What does he say? He asks if I am a doctor, said Melchior. And turning back to the man, he asked, What is it with you? Not me, sir, it is my wife. She is ill. She is in labor. She needs help, badly. Melchior gazed blankly down at the upturned, bearded man, moon pale and tense with desperate entreaty. Then he glanced up at the star-crowded sky above his head. The great ship was now plainly visible, a brilliant, sparkling jewel hanging upon the rim of Zervan's wheel. But even as he wavered, he felt his camel rocking forward onto its knees. Come, he said to his companions. Zervan wills it. Bring what you have. There is still time. But have you taken leave of your senses, Mel? You know that Iphis won't wait. He will wait, replied Melchior calmly. Come. They dismounted and followed the man across the moonlit yard, through an arched doorway, into a long, low shed. At the far end, the small flame of an oil lamp flapped and flickered in the draft. In the stone stalls on either side, long-horned cattle lay quietly chewing their cud. A girl was lying on a heap of hay beneath a wooden grill. Her dark eyes looked enormous in her ashen, sweat-silvered face. Between her naked thighs and still joined to her by its cord lay the child she had just given birth to. Murmuring a prayer to Zervan, Melchior stooped over her and gathered up the tiny, still body. Pressing its face to his lips, he sucked the clotted mucus from its mouth and nose and spat it out. Then he filled his lungs and blew hard into its mouth. Beneath his fingers he felt the pygmy ribcage swell, delicate as a bird's. He removed his lips, pressed inward gently with his strong, broad fingers, and heard the first smell howl of outrage. He gazed down at the puckered little face in astonishment and turned to his companions. "What do I do now?" "Cut through the cord," said Balthazar. "With what?" "Use your teeth. That is what these people do. I have seen it." "You do it, then." "We break the law, Melchior. Do you accept the responsibility?" "Have I not done so already? Do it." Balthazar knelt upon the dry, sweet-smelling hay, lifted the living cord to his lips, and bit it through. "The salve, Caspar," he said. "You have it." Caspar groped within his satchel and drew out a white tube. He twisted it between his fingers, pulled it apart, and handed it to Balthazar, who smeared both ends of the severed cord and then rubbed the protesting infant's body all over with the perfumed ointment. The woman moaned faintly and reached out towards her wailing child. Melchior contrived to wrap it around in a corner of her own garment and then placed it between her hands. She drew it down and held it against her breast. It nuzzled in blindly against the nipple and fell silent. A sudden brightness, like a flash of summer lightning, lit up the whole interior of the shed. "Iphis," cried Caspar. "Go," said Melchior. "Hold him. We will be with you directly." Caspar hurried out into the empty, windy street. Above the hill, behind the village, he could see the rescue capsule hovering in the moonlight like a glittering silver bar. He scrambled up onto the back of the nearest camel and urged the beast into a lolloping canter. Melchior gazed down at the mother and child, wondering if he had done right or wrong. To interfere willfully with an alien life pattern was to flout the universal law. Yet he had done it, and now it could not be undone. He turned to Balthazar, took the two half tubes of salve from him, twisted them together, and presented the salve to the husband. "Take it," he said. "It will heal your wife." "What do I owe you, sir?" "You owe me nothing," said Melchior. "It is a gift." From his finger he slid a slim band of some metal that resembled gold. He stretched it out between his hands until it had grown wide enough to slip over the baby's foot. It encircled the tiny ankle like a bracelet woven from an angel's hair. "Thus do we claim you for Zervan," he murmured. The husband knelt down, bowed his head, and lifted the hem of Melchior's gown to his lips. Awkwardly, Melchior leaned down and patted the man's shoulder. Then he turned and nodded to Balthazar. "Let us be gone," he said. They abandoned their camels at the bottom of the hill and began clambering up the summit on foot. Halfway across the hillside, they saw three men hurrying down towards the village. One of the men shouted something to them as they ran past, but Melchior's twin hearts were pounding too loudly for him to make out the words. 5 minutes later, they had gained the crest of the hill to find Caspar and Iphis Bractor anxiously awaiting them. They climbed aboard the capsule and fled skyward. Gazing down at the Judean hills, dwindling rapidly beneath them, they saw a flock of panic-stricken sheep cascading away down the slope towards Bethlehem. "Those herdsmen will have a curious tale to tell," observed Iphis Bractor wryly. "What delayed you, Melchior?" "Nothing of any great significance," said Melchior. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.